that obliterated a suspected drug boat in the Caribbean. That from War Secretary Pete Hegseth. And it makes boat attack number 10, says ABC's Martha Raddatz.
The USS Ford carrier strike group heading to the region. That carrier, bristling with firepower, including F-18 fighter jets, missile launchers, and attack submarines, adding some 5,000 American forces to the 10,000 already in the region.
Meantime, on the other side of the Caribbean, tropical storm Melissa strengthening, expected to hit Jamaica next week as a Cat 4. Payday was a bust for more than 500,000 federal workers today, thanks to the ongoing government shutdown, some taking charity food handouts. But the Pentagon has confirmed it's accepted an anonymous $130 million donation to help pay troops if the government shutdown continues, President Trump calling the donor a patriot and a friend. This is ABC News.
You're listening to 1490 WLCX. La Crosse is home for Matt Nair on air weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
Eagle 1490.
You're listening to 1490 WLCX. La Crosse is home for Matt Nair on air weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
The Bucks on the road. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports NBA. The Bucks are in Canada tonight to take on the Raptors in Toronto. The team getting word yesterday on MRI showing Kevin Porter Jr. suffered a sprained left ankle in the season opener Wednesday night. No word yet on how long he'll be out. College football, the Badgers head to Eugene to face the number 6th ranked Oregon Ducks. Tomorrow night, they kick off at 6 p.m. Packers head to Pittsburgh tomorrow. They'll play Aaron Rodgers and the Steelers on Sunday night football. Baseball. The Brewers have promoted GM Matt Arnold to become the president of baseball operations.
It's not going to change materially, honestly. I've never really been focused on titles at all. Honestly, it's just been something where you keep your head down and you work hard and good things will happen. Obviously thankful to a ton of people here, including this guy, first and foremost, our ownership, family, like just too many people to thank, but especially the guys that are here that I work with every single day.
That's the Brewers' Matt Arnold with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Ahoo, this is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. California, oh, California. Thursday proposed the 2026 Billionaires Tax Act, known as the California Billionaire Bill. And what this would do, pretty simple, something we've been calling on for a very long time, little wealth tax, but this is a one-time 5% tax on the net worth of people who have wealth accumulated over $1 billion. Not someone who's got 20 million, 30 million, 100 million, 500 million, anyone over $1 billion. One of our billionaires. The measure expected to be on the November 2026 ballot. They say it's going to target about 200 of our ultra wealthy Californians who now have somewhere in the range of $2 trillion in combined wealth. Most of that, a good portion of that, came during the pandemic, where billionaires really, man, just supercharged towards the sky. Now, the bill, pretty straightforward, pretty simple. They want to raise about $100 billion to fill the funding gap in California's Medi-Cal program. Because guess what? We've got a federal government that's walked away from working people and poor people. Massive cuts because of the Trump administration. now under the proposal, 90% of all the revenue that come in from this billionaire tax bill going to go directly to healthcare. Going to restore coverage, going to fund hospitals, going to give services to millions of low and moderate income working folks there in the state of Pennsylvania. 10% going to go to public schools. So all of it going to be used in a very, I don't know, community kind of way. And you go, well, why does this matter? Matters big because this initiative recognizes that while working families are paying more for food and rent and healthcare and all of this stuff, California's billionaires, and I would argue all of our state's billionaires, have seen their wealth multiply massively since at least the pandemic, but since 2010, growing some, 500%, despite benefiting from massive tax loopholes and corporate giveaways. This billionaire bill seeks to restore just a touch of fairness to the tax system. Just a touch that really has overwhelmingly protected inherited wealth and investment wealth while underfunding essential programs, education and transit, and in this case, healthcare and education, but all of the other stuff that we've given away. And it would close, the loophole that let billionaires delay or avoid paying state taxes by relocating assets and reclassifying income. So we're going after the billionaires here. And for the working class, the act could be, transformative. It would safeguard Medi-Cal, their health insurance thing, for some 15 million people in California, preserve thousands of healthcare and education jobs, and also stabilize the state's social safety net without raising taxes on working people. This is the important part of this. You go where the money is. Proponents have called this a modest but moral correction. And I got to tell you, 5%, yeah, it's a nice gesture. Not getting there for me, but it's a start. Look, it's a means of making those who have benefited the most from our system help everyone else sustain our system. Now, you've got the people who are going to fight it with legal battles, and there's going to be the whining and complaining, the wealthy are going to leave. But understand, for many in California, this bill represents a kind of reclaiming of shared prosperity. And I got to tell you, it's long overdue, and this is something that every state should be doing. If they want to flee the country, that's a whole nother story. But this idea that we're going to move across a border in a state here to avoid paying taxes off of wealth that you accumulated somewhere is it's insane. But it's what we've allowed to have happen in this country. We've allowed states to be pitted against each other in economic warfare. This is something the federal government should be doing. This is something we should be pushing for in every state and at the federal level, because we've given, through our hard work, our sweat, our blood, sweat, and tears, we've built the largest billionaire class in the history of humanity. And how did we do it? Through lower wages, less health care, less educational opportunity, less opportunity. That's the reality. Now, you say the federal level, they're not doing anything. Well, Bernie Sanders, and I know everyone on my Red Hat crew loves Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota, but they've introduced a piece of legislation that would have a 60% tax on the pandemic wealth gains by our billionaires. They're saying sometime between March of 2018 and the end of the year. And use that money to do what? Yeah, cover the healthcare costs of working class people who Trump's screwing over right now. Seems like a good idea. Seems like a great idea. Seems like, something we've been talking about on this show for, 20 years now. The idea of a progressive income tax. And this is why I've never been a huge fan of Gavin Newsom's, but I got to tell you, he's got the right messaging. And he's out there with the digits balled up and throwing some haymakers. Pushing back on the idea that California is a high tax state. It is, if you're rich. But I love the fact that he goes, look, the real high tax states are Florida, Texas, those regressive tax states where the Taxes are high for working people, but our billionaires, they get away scot-free. He points out that California is a progressive tax state. The bigger your shoulders, the more water you carry, the more you have, the more you help. Seems that that's the kind of America that I think we all believe in. Not hooray for me and the heck with everybody else, but one where we're all in. So my America First crowd, maybe we should be talking about this first. Maybe we talk about how to help our neighbors, our friends, our family, our loved ones. Just a thought. I want to hear yours. Good idea? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. What do you think of a wealth tax? What do you think of a top marginal tax rate of 92% like we've had in history? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, like I said, good on California. Good on Gavin Newsom. Good on them for pushing this wealth tax, this idea. And this is where I give Gavin Newsom the ultimate credit. He's out there and he's punching back. Democrats, learn a lesson. Get out there and fight back a little bit. The idea that California is this great high tax state, he's been pushing back. And I say, no, it's a progressive tax state to where if you're a billionaire, yeah, you're going to pay higher taxes. But if you're a working person, it's going to be a lot lower. And he hits back saying, look, Texas, Florida, those are high tax states for working people. And I'm hoping that message gets through. And look, you need the messengers out there doing that. And my next guest has been one of those guys for years sounding this alarm. So he's got to be kind of happy with what's going on in California. He's also got a new book out titled Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining the Lives and Our Lives and the Planet. That's why I've asked Chuck Collins to come share some thoughts with us. Chuck is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good there at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can get there at inequality.org. Chuck, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So let's start with the book, Good on You. I got to imagine, Gavin Newsom and the Democrats in California kind of released that right in time for us to have this interview.
Good timing, yeah. I'm glad to see a great example of legislation that taxes billionaires and directs the money to something that really people care about. In this case, 50 million people who are potentially going to lose their health access are going to be able to keep their health access in California with this 5% tax on billionaires in the state.
Now, this is something that we've talked about for years that other states should be doing, the federal government should be doing. I know you're part of the group of patriotic millionaires that have been pushing for a much higher tax rate on the wealthy. All of this stuff, in my view, comes together. And look, in your book, you talk about how the game is rigged, how the ultra wealthy have rigged our systems. Walk us through. What you view as the most harmful ways that the system's been rigged in favor of our billionaires over the lives of everyday working people.
Yeah, I really wrote this book because people still say to me, who cares how rich the rich are? Does it really matter? It doesn't touch my life. And what I argue is it touches every corner of your life. It affects your health. It makes your health worse. The billionaires are opting out of taxes, so they're making you pay more. You've lost your voice and vote in this politically captured democracy. The billionaires have taken away your voice in our democracy. It's bad for the environment. The billionaires are the super polluters. It's even affecting housing. It's driving up the cost of housing and making it harder for working families to find affordable housing. On down the list, it touches every personal day-to-day part of your life, and we need to understand that.
But Chuck, I was just told the other day that the reason that housing's so out of control is, the crisis are so out of control, is because those evil regulations, Chuck. There are too many regulations. It's all Democrats' fault for regulating. It's not our rich people. Our rich people, they're good, hardworking people like the rest of us.
Yeah, you know, just peel it back a little bit. The rich are buying, you know, the billionaire-backed private equity funds are buying up single-family housing. They're buying up rental housing and converting it to short-term rental. They're buying mobile home parks and holding the residents hostage as they raise the rates all through. And then we have these global billionaires coming to the U.S. and parking their money here. And where do they put it? They put it in land and housing, driving up the cost of housing for ordinary people. So whatever housing crisis you see in your community, just remember it is being supercharged by the billionaire class.
But what do you say to the argument? Because I'm sure you've heard them all doing what you do. You know, if we tax the billionaires, Chuck, they're just going to leave. They're going to go somewhere else. They'll go to Texas or Florida or one of those other quote unquote low tax states.
Yeah, you know, we've heard that argument. The reality is people stay in the communities they are in for various reasons. Now, of course, billionaires have multiple homes. They are moving not just around the U.S., but around the planet. They are a highly mobile group, but most of them like to be in places like New York City, Sun Valley, Idaho, California. Do they really want to go to Texas? Some of them do, but most of them are rooted in place, just like most people. Yeah. So, you know, that and we've seen, we've studied a bunch of the states that have levied higher taxes on the rich in the last couple of years. They don't see a bunch of millionaires and billionaires going anywhere. Those folks stick around for the reasons the rest of us stick around. We have communities and neighborhoods and family that we want to be part of.
Yeah, the book Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet, burnedbybillionaires.com, the website, if you want to take a look at that. Now, the book highlights the fact, again, that billionaires wield all of this extreme power, that it undermines democracy. Can you help walk through the average working person? I'm a big advocate of people joining and forming unions to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. How does their having the kind of outweighed wealth and power that they have affect a worker's ability to just, you know, make it ends meet, to be able to organize, to fight for those wages, hours, conditions, or just basic rights? How does it matter?
I mean, one thing to understand is we're kind of in this oligarchy doom loop. The more wealth and power that flows to the top 0.1%, the super powerful rich folk, the more they use their wealth and power to block opportunities for others. That could be funding anti-union campaigns. It could be investing in private equity funds that drive down the cost, say, the wages of healthcare workers. They're always trying to find places where they can squeeze more value out of the economy. And that tends to be workers and taxpayers. So that's, you know, that's one of the ways it touches us. Let me just talk about health. You know, we saw this through the pandemic. The rich got richer. The billionaire class saw their wealth double over the pandemic. And now they're using that wealth to buy up hospitals, to buy up emergency rooms, to slice and dice and sell off the profitable assets and squeeze more. The first thing they do when they invest in a healthcare system is invest in billing and cutting costs, i.e. workers, so that they can squeeze more money out of their customers, out of their patients. That is touching all of our communities.
Yeah. And you know, the weird thing to me, Chuck, and this is one of those things that I've been, you know, talking about for years. You know, you think about Andrew Carnegie, who, you know, was one of our robber barons, was not a good guy in any stretch of the imagination as far as I can find. But he did leave a legacy of public libraries. There was at least something that they that they wanted to be remembered for. I'm not seeing this generation of robber barons with that same kind of legacy thought, because any one of them, Musk, Bezos, they could end childhood poverty. They could end homelessness for veterans or for children. They could do this if they wanted to. And clearly they don't want to, and we're not making them. So it just seems that we're in a weird spot.
Yeah, you know, I've watched, we've studied the philanthropy of the billionaire class, and they tend to fund everything under the sun except two areas: campaigns to raise taxes on the rich and campaigns to help workers organize. That's off limits. You know, billionaire philanthropy is not the answer. Even if some of them, you know, got a benevolent moment in their hearts, it's not a substitute for a fair tax system, a democratically overseen spending regime. Andrew Carnegie was interesting in that he not only gave money to build a lot of libraries, he supported having a robust estate tax, an inheritance tax on inherited wealth. He believed there shouldn't be dynastic, multi-generational fortunes in this country. And if you look around at the billionaires today, it seems like they're investing in dynasty. They want their unborn great-grandchildren to stay billionaires, and they're doing everything they can to rig the rules to help the next generation stay rich.
But at least in past generations of the landed gentry, they at least wanted to have some kind of a legacy of benevolence so that the peasants didn't come with the pitchforks and the platters to put their heads on. Because I don't in my lifetime, I'm not sure we're ever going to get to that point of activism in the working class. Although we're at that, I think, that kind of divide point where historically, I don't know, we're more... Correct me if I'm wrong, we're more unequal now than we were during the Gilded Age.
Yeah, I think there's evidence that the concentration of wealth is even greater. We're probably going to see the first trillionaire before the decade is over. And they control the communication media apparatus and these new technologies, which almost sort of accelerate the extraction and concentration of wealth. So it's a different chapter. And I don't think we can wait around for some of these billionaires to grow old and start thinking about their legacy, because we really don't have decades to solve some of these urgent problems.
So, you know, what's the answer then? I mean, you know, many people are feeling left behind. There's anger on the right for sure, but there's anger on the left too. People are struggling. It's getting harder and harder to make ends meet for the folks in the working class. What concrete steps do you recommend that people take to try and claw back some of the power that our billionaire classes accumulate and really try to build an economy that, you know, yeah, works for everybody a little bit instead of just the one with the most toys when he dies wins?
I mean, we have to fight and elect people who support that program that you just described. They want an economy that works for everybody, not just the super rich. We need to talk to our neighbors about how they're being burned by billionaires. And my book is kind of a primer on how to do that. But then I think we need to support campaigns like the one in California. You tax the rich and you invest in things that really matter to people. So you're concerned about affordable housing, tax luxury real estate transfers at the high level, and invest in affordable housing. You care about the environment, tax private jet fuel. The super rich are flying around in private jets. They don't pay their fair share of the real costs. Tax that and invest in green transit and ground transportation for working people. You want to have debt-free education and job training? Fund tax inheritances at high levels. Prevent the buildup of these dynasties. So those are the kind of things. And those can happen at the state and local level. We don't have to worry about wait for the federal government to get their act together.
But Chuck, that's un-American. We've never done such a thing in this country. And when I become a billionaire, I don't want to have to pay it.
Actually, we did it not that long ago. You know, if you go back and look the 50s and 60s and 70s, we taxed wealth at high levels invested it in a way that shared prosperity. It's because we had a labor movement that was a third of the workforce and they could push for policies that helped ordinary working people. So we actually know how to do this, and we've done it even in recent times.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you're part of a group that this is your issue. You were someone of privilege. You're someone who most of us would say, you know, kind of won the game. You know, why is it important to you? I mean, you're someone who you would never had to work a day in your life, or as I understand, I could be wrong. And I've talked to a lot of folks who are, quote unquote, won the game. You know, why do you care?
Well, I think it's these extreme inequalities of wealth are bad for everybody. Even people who can think of themselves as wealthy. The patriotic millionaires are people who say it's my long-term self-interest for people who are wealthy to pay more taxes, to, if you own a business, pay your workers a living wage, $30 an hour by 2030. That seems like a reasonable proposal. Reduce the influence of money in politics. So yeah, people should check out the patriotic millionaires. I'm a little bit different. I gave away the inherited wealth I had in my 20s, so I have had to work for a living. But hey, that's okay. Just like what 99.5% of my neighbors. So, but I'm an honorary member of the Patriotic Millionaires, helped to co-found it because I believe organizing the wealthy is part of what we need to do to organize everybody.
Because look, I know a lot of people who hope to one day be well off. And look, I don't have a problem with people working hard, playing by the rules, getting ahead, if that's possible anymore. And I want everybody to be comfortable and wealthy. There's a point, though, at which you're talking about wealth that's so obscene that it's actually destructive. And I think this is what your book really is about, is that it's so obscene that it's not being used for productive purposes, for democracy, for civilization, that this kind of hoarding of power is, well, destructive to everybody else. So I see there's a justification for going, look, maybe we don't have these handful of people the kind of power and control that we've given them.
Yeah, and I think this is a real important point. I try to emphasize this in my book. We're not talking about wealth, we're talking about power. And my view is when you hit that $30 to $40 million level, you've met all your needs and desires, your kids are fine, you have multiple houses, you probably are flying on a jet. When you go over $30-40 million, you are not just buying a mansion or a jet, you're buying a senator and a news outlet. And you're using that wealth and power to capture the political system and influence and dominate and rule over everyone else. And that's when we should wave the flag and say, too much concentrated wealth and power, enough is enough. We need to tax that and return it back to society and invest in things that help non-wealthy people have good lives. It's not that complicated. A friend of mine, Scott Ellis, just wrote an op-ed. He says, I'm a millionaire, but I don't need more than $30 million. And if I say I need more than $30 million, come and tax it away.
No, I mean, that's an incredibly succinct way of putting that. And I think a way that everyone can understand, because look, I don't want people to be poor with tin. I don't want Jeff Bezos out on the street corner with a tin cup. But, I don't want Elon Musk begging, selling pencils. But, we're talking about the first trillionaire, potentially trillionaire, while we've got children who go to bed hungry and vets who are sleeping on the streets and people working for poverty wages. Look, that wealth didn't come from just nowhere. In the past, in my grandparents' era, in my great-grandparents' era, those were workers' wages. That's what built the most prosperous working class in history. And I think that's an important point to be made.
Yeah, Bill Gates' dad, I used to work with him, and he used to say, no one does it alone. If you have that level of wealth, you might have worked hard, but in fact, you're fortunate, you probably have lucky timing, and you live in a society where together we've made investments in infrastructure and knowledge and things that create the fertile ground for wealth creation. Nobody does it alone. Everybody has help from workers, colleagues, communities, taxpayers. Let's understand wealth doesn't exist outside that web that we all create together. Yeah, it matters what you do in the morning. It matters, Rick, that you work harder than I do. You should get a little bit more, but not 1,000 times more, not 1,000,000 times more. I shouldn't have to live in my car and you fly a jet just because there's a little bit of difference in our effort. That's the key point here.
Or our fortune, burned by billionaires, how concentrated wealth and power are ruining our lives and planet. Chuck Collins, the author, burnedbybillionaires.com, the website where you can get that last bit. What do you want people to take from this? What's the hope that comes out of it? Everyone writes a book for a purpose. What are you hoping folks get from this?
I hope that people will go through their day and they see a harm or they see something that's broken in their society and they say, damn billionaires, that they understand and take it personally how the billionaires are trashing our society and our lives and our communities, and that we can do something about that.
So you're talking about a which side are you on moment, you know, going back to the history of the labor movement. You could see the Carnegies and the Vanderbilts. You could see the palaces that they were building while people were living in shanty towns and stuff. And you knew which side. Maybe that's what you're talking about. But Chuck, I appreciate the time. Great book. Hope folks will take a look at it. BurnedByBillionaires.com. Chuck Collins, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Is Chuck right? Maybe we should be paying attention a little bit. And maybe when things aren't going so well, we go, maybe it is our billionaires at fault. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to 1490 WLCX, Lacrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show, weekday afternoons from 2 to 4.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Clouds thicken for tonight, some showers late and a low in the upper 30s. Maybe a morning shower, then for tomorrow a mix of sun and clouds, highs in the mid-50s. Partly sunny and highs in the upper 50s on Sunday. Rain chances return again Monday and Tuesday. It's 42 right now.
Hey there, Wisconsin. Tom Hartman here. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so join me each and every weekday right here on Civic Media for the Tom Hartman program from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Covering the news of the day and sharing ways for you to get off the sidelines and get active in your community, because change starts with you. Get involved and tune in to the Tom Hartman program Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Carolyn Leavitt, definitely not Leavitt, the press secretary, had an interesting comment. On Thursday, basically saying that, you know, the president is focused 100%. How did she put it again? His main focus is, because his mind's always working, according to her. He's always churning things out. But she was asked, you know, whether you know, had plans to do other reservations. She said, his mind's always working. You know, he's a builder, right? At heart, clearly, she said. And so his heart and his mind is always churning about how to improve things here at the White House grounds. And at this moment, of course, the ballroom is really the president's main priority. It's the main priority. You know, never mind the thousands, the tens of thousands of government workers who are you know, standing in food lines, literally standing in food lines. Never mind that. Never mind the services that aren't being done. Never mind the soldiers. Ballroom. The ballroom is the most important thing. And here to share some thoughts on, well, is the ballroom really the most important thing? Or should it be? That's why I've asked my good friend Phil Glover to come share some thoughts. Phil is the District 3 National Vice President of the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, their website. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate being on.
So the big, beautiful ballroom, that's the main priority. Basically, screw you guys.
Yeah, basically 700,000 employees not getting paid in the federal government. Another 650,000 working without pay, driving into work and out of work. And he's worried about a ballroom and tearing down the east wing of the White House.
Now, you have been in government employ for many, many years. This is a story that, unfortunately, you as a working person have had to go through. And you know, it's hard. You know, every person that I talk to, there's another story. There's another heartache. There's a tragedy. Because look, lives are complicated. People are struggling. And this isn't helpful. So do you have an experience of missing a paycheck, two, five, what?
Yeah, I was in I was in one of the longest shutdowns that I was part of. We missed three paychecks, 1995 shutdown, when Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton couldn't get a deal together. So, you know, these are terrible for people who have any, you know, people have health problems, their family does, or other, you know, people that are attending college, you know, who are overstressed on their bills, maybe went a little too far on the size house they bought or whatever. You know, you're tight, you're paycheck to paycheck. And when that paycheck comes in and it's light or it's non-existent, you know, people get into a panic and they're trying to find ways to take care of their families.
You know, we've seen a number of stories that have popped up, you know, a number of high profile get togethers with talking heads. Most recently, there was an air traffic controller saying, hey, I got to go drive for a rideshare company so I can pay my kids' tuition. And it was like people were shocked by that. But, you know, people have to do what they have to do in these moments. And it shouldn't be this way. And look, on Thursday, the Senate again failed to move forward to agree to pay people. Walk me through what the feelings are of your members.
Well, I think they're pretty disappointed in all of this. They're discouraged. A lot of them are fearful. And of course, the comments coming out of Russell Vogt at the White House is, you know, well, while we have the government shut down, we can fire a bunch of people. That'd be great. And you had Tommy Tuberville the other day, the senator from Alabama, I think, you know, saying now's the time to privatize a bunch of government because it's closed. So, you know, that side of the aisle is taking advantage of this. And then the Democratic side of the aisle, frankly, you know, the negotiations that are going on don't really affect federal employees much. The ACA tax credits aren't something that really affects feds. However, it could affect rates. And so in the abstract, federal employee rates for their health care could go up significantly more because of those ACA tax credits being gone.
As could every worker in this country because of that. You know, when you're screwing with the system, I mean, clearly everyone will be affected by this, which is why I think the Democrats have staked this ground. Now you've got John Fetterman, who has said that he's willing to use the nuclear option to break the filibuster to move forward on this. And look, I'm not a fan of the filibuster in any way, shape, or form, but I don't know that a carve out for this specifically is. If you want to do away with it, go ahead, do away with it. But I'm not sure. I'm curious. Do you have a thought?
Yeah, I have a thought on that. Senator Fetterman's not listening to his constituents, and he certainly isn't listening to federal employees. The problem here is that the filibuster is the only thing that gives either party leverage on a piece of legislation in the Senate. And so what he's essentially saying is we will now allow the entire federal workforce to be dealt with by the Republican Party. And if you think of the bills that they have tried to put forward on the federal workforce to privatize, to do all the things that they want to do, he's giving them carte blanche to do that and frankly voting for it. We told him in the spring when the CR was done, we asked him to try to leverage an amendment into the bill, keeping the government open to give us our collective bargaining rights back or to protect us from further cuts from the administration. And none of that happened. He refused to do any of that. So he just said, we don't have the votes to do that. And as far as I'm concerned, sometimes you have to fight whether you have the votes or not.
No. Sometimes you got to get in there and mix it up. You know, my argument that you know, in a street fight, Democrats will offer to hold your coat.
Well, that's what I mean. Look, I walked and knocked for Senator Fetterman when he ran. When he wasn't able to speak after his stroke, our union, you know, we still went out and supported him to get him elected over Oz. And now it just seems that he's forgotten all of that and doesn't want to hear from federal workers very much. And, you know, doesn't want to argue, doesn't want to really have a discussion about why we feel the way we do, that negotiations need to happen to reopen this government. No
Absolutely.
Doubt.
And the negotiations need to happen, Phil. Leverage. Absolutely. And this is one of those weird moments where I hear people saying that, the Democrats are totally responsible for this, that Republicans are basically held harmless, the president has nothing to, our dear leader has nothing to do with it. Well, as I understand it, Trump again has rejected the Democrats' offer to meet and to have a meeting and try and negotiate. The Republicans in the Senate don't seem to be very trustworthy on this issue. And when Fetterman says that he believes Thune is sincere, I got to tell you, I'm not feeling that kind of trust coming out of Thune and the Republicans in this moment. And I don't think most Democrats are either.
Well, I mean, the thing is how can you be? They passed a CR that required 60 votes in the spring. Then they come into August and they put up a rescission bill that takes $9 billion out of that funding. And that only had to pass by 51 votes in the Senate. So why, as a Democratic senator, would you trust that you had an arrangement with the Republicans and you got them the other 10 votes or the other 7 votes they need to pass something with 60 votes, and then they can turn around and do a rescission bill with 51 votes? Now, how Senator Fetterman can't look at that and say, they're not really trustworthy. They're not.
Yeah.
So you know, that's my mind.
So, I'm reading stories today and for the last couple of days that the reduction in force, the RIFs are coming, as you pointed out, vote and the rest of them are using this opportunity. This is kind of their wet dream that they're going to be able to fire and privatize and do all this stuff, which kind of leads me in the direction that, this is what they wanted because they've been playing this out in their think tanks for years. And they have no need or want to try and negotiate. What's going on? I mean, we hear all these stories, thousands of workers being fired, permanently replaced. What agencies, where are you seeing is this happening? And then, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, I think, HUD is one of the ones hit by this, Housing and Urban Development, which they've wanted to get rid of that agency for years. EPA, that's another place that these kind of things are happening. Some of these smaller agencies, Voice of America, all the ones that they went after right away at the beginning, now's a chance to hit them again. And for our understanding is about 4,900 employees have been told that they're going to be reduced, reduction in force. Now, Department of Energy as well. So what we've seen, AFG immediately filed into federal court when Russell Vogt made these comments that he was going to use this to do RIFs. We do have a preliminary injunction in place right now. We're supposed to be going to a hearing soon on those issues. However, here we are again. The appellate courts have failed us. The appellate courts have failed to even back up their own federal judges. If you look at what just happened in Portland, you had a federal judge appointed by Trump who stopped him from using the National Guard there because the arguments about an armed rebellion were ridiculous, stopped it, and 2 out of 3 members of the Circuit Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit ruled that, no, we can't second-guess the commander-in-chief. He gets to do this. Even though the facts on the ground don't, This is a movement towards something that we've never seen in this country.
No, you're absolutely right. And the weird thing is, I hate to be beating up on John Fetterman, but he's put himself in this position. He said that, Kamala Harris lost because she missed the plot and called Trump a fascist. But I'm looking at what's going on here, Phil. I'm seeing with my own 2 eyes what this administration is doing every single day. And I don't know that there's a better word for it than that. I wish the senator would come forward with whatever that word is. If it's something else, I would love to know it. But I'd like to know.
If he cannot see that this regime has become an authoritarian regime, he ignores Congress. He is ignoring Congress. He ignores funding bills. He ignores authorizing legislation. So that's first one. Article 1, throw it out. Then you have Article 3, the judiciary. They have ignored, pushed off, tried to go around the judiciary when they have made rulings against him. They find another way. He, as he said, in, you know, with some of these military deployments, he will use the Insurrection Act next. Now, you know, he's looking for a way to do what he wants to do, which is to send militarized troops into cities, into Democratic elected cities. And this is the other thing. He keeps talking about how bad the leadership is in these cities and states. These are duly elected people, just like if you want to say he was elected, he was. It is unreal that the American public cannot separate that, and especially on the right side of the aisle, and senators too. You wait, if we do get a fair election and a Democrat wins, they're not going to want the military being sent into Republican states, into red states.
I think I think they're betting on the fact that Democrats won't. The Democrats aren't going to do the extreme stuff that they're getting away with right now. They don't fear the other edge of the sword, so to speak. And that's I think that's a problem, because I think Democrats for too long have shown that they believe in the rule of law. They believe in institution. They believe in the guardrails of democracy. And they're not willing to go over that line. And there's part of me that goes, maybe it's time to start looking there in a real serious way. But I don't think they're afraid at all.
Well, and I wouldn't want the country to go that direction either. I mean, I don't want us to be where we are now. I mean, as a federal employee, as a law enforcement officer, which I was both, I was an MP, I was a corrections officer for 25 years. And you know, I was in the military. I don't want to see us where we are. But the fact is, this stuff should scare people. And Mr. Fetterman and others up there on the Hill ought to really be paying attention. Maybe go back and read some things from 1933, 34, and onward to figure out what this looks like. Because these are incremental. This is an incremental move, every one of these things.
Yep.
And you don't just turn into a fascist country overnight. There are incremental moves, and you go back and read history and you see what happened. A certain segment of the population is demonized. They start to push, militaristic rule in these cities, and it just keeps going. And do we want to be there as Americans? I hope not.
Now, look, the water's boiling. We are the frog in the boiling water. It's time to start jumping. You brought up the fact that you were in the military, you're a veteran, you're MP, all of that stuff. I got to get your thought before I let you go on something that my congressman, Republican Scott Perry, had to say recently on another program. He said they hate the military. He's talking about Democrats. That's only a credential that they get when they want to run for office. They join the military, they serve a little bit, and they get their credential, and then they run for office and wear the uniform and say, look at me, I support America. But let's face it, he said, all their votes say they don't support America. He said they don't care about the Constitution or the nation's defense. With your background, and you hear that from my congressman, what do you think?
Well, again, I think they are gaslighters. I think he's a gaslighter. I think he is one of these guys that has wrapped himself around in the flag as someone who served. He served, I served. But the fact is, we're allowed to have different viewpoints in America about how the country should be ran. And unfortunately, they have gotten into this idea that they're the only ones that get to carry a flag around. And as a Democrat, and I've been a Democrat probably since Bill Clinton, I voted for Reagan when I was in the military. But the fact is, what I have seen over the years is how you treat federal employees, how you treat the military, all these things. I think Democratic Party has tried to do a good job at those things. And Mr. Perry, you know, he's absent. The guy does nothing on Capitol Hill.
I can tell you that. But let me ask you this, because, as we've been talking about this, the water boiling, a military that is ideological is part of that. And the fact that they are right now trying to even further divide the country on the military. Again, this is another one of those divisive tactics to put our team on separate teams. And I think, you know, from not just from a national unity standpoint, from a national security standpoint, this is not a good thing. This is a really, really bad situation to be in.
Yeah, I served in the 118th Airborne MP Company in the 18th Airborne Corps, and I also served in the 82nd Airborne. And I can tell you, none of us talked about politics. I mean, as troops, I didn't know what the next guy was. I didn't know how he voted. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't, you know, but Ronald Reagan didn't come to Fort Bragg and have pep rallies. He didn't come to Fort Bragg and hand out Merck. That's the difference here. Trump has stood in front of our troops and bashed the former president of the United States. This has not been done. This is not appropriate. And you haven't heard Congressman Perry say, oh, man, this is bad. Don't do this. Don't do it.
No, where was
that's what he should be doing.
Where was Scott Perry when Pete Hegseth was calling all our military leaders fat, weak, and woke?
Right. Pull 800 generals together and attack them. Yeah. These guys, by the way, had to go through the Army War College and other colleges. They have bachelor's, master's degrees, PhDs. These guys train and train and train to be generals at that level. I was never at that level. I was an NCO.
Yeah, but Phil, they're just doing it to get the credential. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like us. I didn't go out and I take my sergeant stripes and run for office. I did my duty in the military. I came back. I got a job. I take care of my family. That's what we do. But the fact is, he doesn't own patriotism. What pisses me off about those kind of guys is they think they own patriotism. And the Democratic Party better step up. And that's why a bunch of veterans in the Democratic Party are stepping up and saying, hey, enough of this. Enough. I serve too. You don't get to have this.
Yep.
And I've been making that clear when I've been out talking to anybody.
Good on you, Phil. As always, I appreciate the time. I know you'll be back because this is not going to end anytime soon, or I fear well, but I want to keep us up to date on what's going on. But Phil Glover, thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Rick. Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You ready for the big ballroom? Maybe they can rent it out for weddings, you know, things like that, since that seems to be the focus, right? That's the focus, 100% focused. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day that the federally mandated 40-hour work week went into effect for U.S. workers. The 40-hour week had been passed as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Making 5 days of 8 hours work the national standard had long been a top goal for labor. For decades, union members organized, demonstrated, went on strike, and even died for the right to work 8 hours. Labor argued that reducing the long, unregulated hours of toil was a matter of workers' health and safety. It was also a matter of dignity. A more reasonable work week would give workers the time to spend with their families, to pursue other interests, and to have a full life outside of the grinding schedule demanded by many bosses. Before the turn of the 20th century, the 8-hour day movement declared 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will as their motto. In 1886, nationwide rallies and strikes for 8 hours took place on May 1st. Today, May Day is celebrated as a workers' holiday around the world in remembrance of that struggle. In 1888, the American Federation of Labor took up the cause, and the Carpenters Union became the standard bearer for the 8-hour day. 10 years later, the United Mine Workers Union members won the 8-hour workday. In 1916, the Adamson Act made 8 hours the standard for interstate railroad workers. A decade after that, Ford Motor Company, a leader in U.S. industry, established the 40-hour work week. Each of these victories were a step along the way to making the 8-hour day a reality and the law of the land. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, you know, the more I think about what's going on in D.C., the angrier I get. And the angrier we should all get. The fact that billionaires have had so much power and so much control and extracted so much wealth from the working class, that you've got federal workers. And this is where I'm struggling in this moment. You've got federal workers who are literally living hand to mouth. And in food lines, look, I had someone send me just the other day a story from CNN, and saying that, you know, there was a food bank in D.C. and they were holding a federal employees specific day for you know, people with federal IDs who work for the federal government to come and get a box of food so that they could feed their families because no paycheck. And the response that I got was, you know, kind of a callous, you know, more of, I don't really care about these workers kind of, you know, kind of weird positioning, and more of a, well, you know, can you believe that they would turn people away who don't have jobs? And I'm like, do you know that, you know, a good majority of the people who get food from food banks actually work? Just like a large number of people who are homeless actually have jobs. And it really... this is another that kind of poor shaming, kind of working class shaming that goes on. That's really frustrating. The sad reality is most federal workers don't make the kind of money that the nonsense chain emails of the past and now internet hoax posts. You know, not every federal employee is a millionaire. Not everyone has contacts to Elon. Most of them are working just to keep a roof over their head. And when you have these kind of disruptions, like Phil talked about, the fact that, you know, he had problems when he missed paychecks, like everyone does. The anger here shouldn't be at federal workers who need help. The anger should be at a system that, well, can't seem to function. And who's responsible for that system? I blame us. I blame we, the working people, who have been so easily divided by those billionaires. Because you know who's not going out without a meal today? Our billionaires. Do you know who's not worried about paying their rent? Our billionaires. You know who's not driving an Uber or a Lyft to pay their child's tuition? Our billionaires. And they're the ones behind all of this. They're the man behind the curtain. Only, well, ours is wearing a, you know, an orange costume and building a big ballroom. What, in some 90,000 square foot ballroom, some gaudy, never mind. They say it's $200 million. It's going to cost $200 million. And then I've seen $250 to $300 million. I'm waiting for the, well, you know, we had cost overruns for those scab contractors who are building it because we didn't build union with project labor agreement and with prevailing wage or with anything else because we did it with private money. So we can screw workers however we want. So when we, the taxpayers, eventually pick up the bill, and oh, trust me, we're going to pick up a good part of the bill. We will have a monument to this moment, and maybe we earned it. Maybe we have earned what's coming. But to send me articles about struggling public sector workers who are just trying to feed their families, I don't know. I'm struggling with it. I want to hear your thoughts. Who's to blame in all of this? Is it the Democrats for standing up for health care? Even if John Fetterman says, well, we knew. Or is it the Republicans who see this as a wet dream opportunity to do all of the crazy stuff that they wanted to do, they've been fantasizing in their think tanks to do to us? Or is it the billionaires who control everything, who this is what they really want? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Pentagon sending a carrier group to Venezuela's doorstep, part of what President Trump calls his war on drug cartels. ABC's Martha Raddatz on the new airstrike that obliterated a suspected drug boat in the Caribbean today.
Hegseth saying at least six people were killed, claiming without evidence the boat was being operated by Tren de Aragua, a designated terrorist organization. It's the 10th known military attack on alleged drug boats, including two in the eastern Pacific Ocean off Central America.
D.C. police say five people were shot near Howard University tonight. None were Howard students. Three weapons recovered, and police have two suspects in custody. An anonymous donor who President Trump calls a patriot and a friend.